in October 1989, and only a few weeks later, 3 weeks later, on the 9th of November, the Berlin Wall came down. That was actually a mishap on part of the GDR regime. They wanted to make it easier to travel to the West, but they did not want to open the border completely. But the funnily enough, the spokesperson at the time of the government, he made a mistake and simply miscommunicated what had been decided, and he said, well, the border is open as of now. And that was in the middle of the night, so people started crossing the border, and we all know the pictures. So and that was the beginning of the end. So it's 9th of November 1989, 3rd of October 1990, reunification happened. So it was not even 11 months later.
Hello and welcome to this month's Aaron's podcast. I'm Rory Montgomery. Our topic this time is Irish Unity, Lessons from Germany. That's the title of a recently published paper by Professor Tobias Locke, who's the Jean Monnet Chair of EU Law at Maynooth University. And I'm very glad to have him here with me today. And also with me is Professor Aoife O'Donoghue of Queen's University Belfast School of Law. So you're both most welcome. Tobias, maybe you could kick off by just telling us a bit about the scope of the paper and the questions you were trying to ask and answer in it.
Well, yes. Hello. What I've been trying to do is I wanted to provide a legal analysis, and I wanted to provide a comparative legal analysis for two reasons. The first is I'm a legal scholar, so I can't tell you very much about the politics or the economics of unification, but I can tell you something about processes and legal questions. And the second reason is that I'm German, so I thought, you know, I should probably contribute to the debate from that angle. And so that also explains perhaps the limitations of the paper. I mean, there are so many themes that one could explore, also in a comparative perspective between Ireland and Germany, the economics, the social security questions, institutional questions, all of those things. But I can really only speak about law, and perhaps that is something I should mention. I mean, I do mention issues that, you know, the key problem, certainly, or the key challenge with Irish unity would, of course, be what to do with the unionists in Northern Ireland. And obviously, Germany doesn't give us an example or give us a solution for this. And because I'm only a lawyer, I can't really dwell on about it. So I mention it as an issue, but I can't provide you with any solutions for it. And that is, of course, a bit disappointing maybe for some who might read the paper. But I hope that the paper nonetheless shows some of the challenges and some of the things that need to be thought about purely from the point of view of uniting two jurisdictions with the end result of having a functioning legal order and a functioning state at the end of it. And that I hope I was able to do.
Yes, absolutely. You certainly did, in my view. And as we were agreeing earlier, questions of process in diplomacy and politics can be almost as important as questions of substance. Maybe just for our listeners, you might, and I'm asking you to fit the proverbial quart into the pint pot, would you give us a very quick sort of recapitulation of the different stages of German unification, which occurred very rapidly, as one recalls?
Yes. So, I mean, as most people, most listeners will probably know, I mean, Germany was divided after the Second World War into East Germany, German Democratic Republic, GDR, which was a socialist state, and West Germany, which was the Federal Republic of Germany, the name that the country still has, that's the official name of Germany, Federal Republic of Germany, or West Germany, as it was called, which was, you know, and is a Western-style liberal democracy, very much influenced by American and British, and to a lesser extent, perhaps French ideas of how things should be run. Now, in the summer of 1989, or throughout the summer of 1989, GDR citizens started leaving the GDR. They couldn't do so directly, but what they did is they went on holidays in other eastern states, Hungary in particular, but also the Czech Republic, and they were able to cross the border to the west from there because these states started opening up their borders. And that led to a mass exodus of citizens, as hundreds of thousands of people left the GDR that way, usually younger people, the ones that, you know, were still actively involved in employment and all of that. So that provided a challenge to the GDR. And that was then coupled with the so-called Monday demonstrations, which started in Leipzig. So every Monday, people used to come together and challenge the regime. And they said, we are the people. That was their slogan. Wir sind das Volk. We are the people. And they were asking for democratic, for reforms. I mean, a more democratic GDR. This then led to the resignation of the long-serving chief of the state, Erich Honecker. And in October 1989, and only a few weeks later, 3 weeks later, on the 9th of November, the Berlin Wall came down. That was actually a mishap on part of the GDR regime. They wanted to make it easier to travel to the West, but they did not want to open the border completely. But the funnily enough, the spokesperson at the time of the government, he made a mistake and simply miscommunicated what had been decided. And he said, well, the border is open as of now. And that was in the middle of the night. So people started crossing the border. And we all know the pictures. So and that was the beginning of the end. So it's 9th of November, 1989, 3rd of October, 1990, reunification happened. So it was not even 11 months later. Mm. So what happened in between was a cascade of events and negotiations and trying to pull things together at lightning speed, really, when you think about it. So Helmut Kohl, who was the chancellor of West Germany, leader of West Germany, announced very quickly at the end of November his own 10-point plan, which was largely words, but it led the way towards reunification. I mean, at the time he spoke of a confederation of the two German states, which is interesting because, you know, that changed very quickly to, you know, reunification. But still, I mean, he set the pace. And that, of course, caught the GDR on the back foot. It also caught those in the opposition of the GDR, I think, on the back foot, those who wanted reform of the state, but they didn't want reunification. They wanted to stay in a socialist state, you know. But that wasn't going to happen. So Kohl and his government realized, OK, we have to get a few things in place. Most important thing was negotiations with the former allies, Second World War allies, who still had some reservations as to German sovereignty. So they had to give their consent to reunification. Of course, they also had to make sure that the GDR stayed on the path of a peaceful transition rather than the military being called in. So it was very important to get the Soviets and keep the Soviets sweet, which they were able to do because Gorbachev was in power. Again, his reign was not stable, which is important to remember. So maybe he would have, which might explain the speed at which all of this was conducted. So what happened then, next big step, was really that the first free elections happened, the first and only free elections of the GDR in March 1990. They resulted in the Christian Democrats, basically the mirror image of Helmut Kohl's party, and some coalition partners, broadly speaking from the centre-right, winning the election, and they had won on a manifesto promise to effect German unification as quickly as possible. So that was the decision made for German unification as quickly as possible, and not going down the route of two German states and seeing how it goes, and, you know, I mean, having a more democratic socialist state in the East and the Western Germany that we know. Soon after that new government took office, soon after that, the European Communities, as they were then called, at the Dublin Summit, so here in Ireland, so Ireland had a role to play in all of this, agreed that, you know, unification could go ahead and that East Germany would automatically be part of the EEC, and certain things were agreed. We can get back to that later. And then the first important thing happened. There was a treaty on monetary, economic and social union. So what happened was interesting is that the economics preceded the politics in terms of reunification. So the first thing that was introduced into the GDR was the German mark, the D-mark, at a very favorable exchange rate for East Germans, 1-1. They were able to. There was a monetary union in May 1990. There was also the introduction of market economy, which they didn't have, of course, and of the German, West German social security system. And then there were negotiations were ongoing between the powers, the four allied powers from the Second World War and the two Germanies on the one side, and then inter-German negotiations about the precise ramifications of how unification should happen on the other side. And all of these treaties fell into place in August and September, respectively. And then October, 3rd of October, that was the day of unity. And that was it. Shortly thereafter, we had elections, first for the Länder parliament. So Germany is, of course, a federal republic. So we have a state level, a level below the federal level. And there were five new states in East Germany had been reformed. During the GDR's lifetime. And then in December we had the first federal elections, and that was the end of, that was it done, basically.
I'll come to you, Aoife, just in a second, but what an extraordinarily quick sequence of events, as you say, from the 9th of November to the 3rd of October, less than 11 months. And also, of course, I suppose, looking at it at least superficially, the differences from the Irish situation are very considerable. I mean, clearly this was an event of a major European and international geopolitical importance. The reasons for the division were very different. I suppose the economic situations were much more different than they would be in our case. But equally, there was no question of a sort of division on grounds of identity or otherwise. So, but there are many interesting parallels as well, as we'll get to. Aoife, you wanted to come in.
Yes, it struck me as I was reading the article that it seemed to be slightly unclear how much of it, and I'd be interested in your opinion to base on this, how much of it had to do with the pre-existing legal structures, that the assumptions in the Constitution, for instance, that there was one Germany in the West German Constitution, as kind of a foregrounding of constitutional intent. But also, I suppose, going back further, that Germany had been one state in a similar way to the way, if we go back 100 years, there was, a single polity on the island as part of a much broader. Like, how much of those sort of older legal structures, which meant there was some commonality in the law came from the same place, people understood law in very similar ways, but also the way that, a constitutional structure which is pointing towards a possible combined unity, how much impact did that in setting up the way that the politics moved and the swiftness of the politics? Did that assist the swiftness that, people, there was a common understanding of law? I'm thinking here in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, for instance, the common law, there's parliamentary democracy, there's, very similar structures. Economic structures would be quite similar from a legal perspective as well. So do you think that did those assumptions assist in the speed at which everything else got to move? The prehistory of unity as one polity, but then the sort of assumptions built into the system that was a likely future place to end up, if not absolutely the future, a likelihood?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, West Germany was certainly founded as a provisional entity. It was never meant to last for as long as it did, I think. It was always meant to reunite with East Germany and initially also with the kind of eastern bits of Germany that were ceded to the Soviet Union, Poland, which then, in the 1970s, West Germany gave up its claim on. So that was clear, but from the GDR's perspective, that was certainly never envisaged. I think the original constitution of the GDR still wanted, or at least mentioned, name-ticked unification. But the constitution that was in place in 1989, which I think dated back to 1968, if I'm not mistaken, that didn't mention anything about unification. They did not want to be reunited with the West, not even as a socialist state or anything. They wanted to be something separate. They were the anti-fascist state, whereas the West was the fascist state in their view. So that's one thing. But certainly, I think it helped to have this general consensus that reunification at some point should be happening. I think that was there in West Germany, but I think that's also there in Ireland. I mean, the Irish state was always meant to be as a provisional a thing, waiting for reunification or unification to happen. The one law thing is an interesting one, because I mean, East Germany certainly didn't have the same law as West Germany, and while it would have had that until obviously 1945 or even preceding that, I think the lawyers from the East, they would have had to relearn quite a lot, I think. Now, I'm not an expert in private law and how how different the civil code of the GDR was to the civil code of West Germany, but there wouldn't have been that much of a common understanding, I don't think, in that sense. So in that sense, it would have been harder from an East German point of view than it would be in the Irish case, where I would imagine that a Northern Irish common lawyer will relatively easily find their way around whatever the United Ireland's law will be. I mean, it's not going to be dramatically alien to them. So to answer your question, yes, I think that the fact that the structures were there, and the fact that the constitution was always meant to be open to unification, certainly made things easier. But I think by the time 89 came around, nobody really believed that was going to happen in their during their tenure as a government, or even in the next 10 or 20 years. I think it came very surprising to them.
I suppose I should say here that I was not even a fly, maybe a tiny bug on the wall in April 1990, because I was at the European Council in Dublin Castle, which Ireland held because in those days there was a rotating EU presidency. I think at times we've tended to, especially in speeches and so on, claim more credit than perhaps we deserve. We happen to be the hosts rather than the organisers of the event. But nonetheless, it was a great achievement. And my colleagues in foreign affairs, who were subsequently ambassador to Germany, told me that it was always something they could reliably depend on in conversations with German leaders about the past. And in fact, Helmut Kohl, even into old age, was very, very emphatic about this whenever he met Irish colleagues. Clearly, Cole's extraordinary speed owed a huge amount both to his own political instinct, I suppose, but also the very, febrile international situation. And I suppose he wanted to establish facts on the ground as quickly as he could. But maybe we could move on to talk a bit more about questions of phasing and timing. You've talked about the period up to October or up to December 1990 and the elections, and things were decided in principle at remarkable speed. But presumably not everything was fully tied down. Not every I was dotted and every T was crossed by then.
No, it wasn't. So it's quite interesting to, I mean, it's perhaps boring for anyone who's not a lawyer, but for those of us who are interested in these kinds of things, it is quite interesting to actually look at those two treaties that were concluded, the one on monetary, economic and social union, and then the actual treaty on unity. And I mean, obviously they're technically treaties concluded between two more or less sovereign states. But in reality, they were, of course, written by West German civil servants. And the lead on this was Wolfgang Schäuble. I mean, he was in charge of all of this as a political lead. And he's quite a decent lawyer. So I suppose he had some input in that as well. And they are written basically like legislation. So they're very, very, very thorough pieces. But also what they do is they go through, so they used the structure of German ministries at the time, the portfolio of German ministries. So they went through those and they basically looked at every piece of legislation that these ministries were in charge of. And they said, OK, this is going to enter into force here and there. Here we're going to have certain transitional, some phasing in and phasing out of GDR law. So, I mean, a lot of GDR law was, fairly inane politically, say family law or even some basic contract law would have been fairly inoffensive. And so they were phasing in and out certain GDR rules, phasing in federal German rules and phasing out GDR rules. They used a technique of instructing the legislators. I mean, obviously in a federal system, you have two sorts of legislators. So they instructed the different legislators to pass legislation on certain topics with a certain policy steer, I would think, which of course can be done because this was an international treaty. So the Federal Republic later on was under an international obligation to transpose that obligation into domestic law. So those are some of the techniques that they would have used. And so it's quite interesting to read this. Now, obviously, you have to be an expert in, say, social security law in order to fully appreciate what they had actually done. They were the techniques that they were looking at. So they decided certain substantive questions in those treaties. Others, they shifted onto the legislators. Others still, they decided certain things should be phased in and phased out at certain points in time. So you can play with time a lot, I think, in these kinds of scenarios. And that they used to great effect, I think.
I'll ask Aoife to come in a second, but Tobias, have you any idea how long did it take until all of the phasing in and phasing out was complete? At what point were the two Germanys, you know, absolutely on the same footing across the different areas of policy and law that you mention?
It took a very long time. Obviously, the beauty of having a federal system is you never have to be completely on the same footing. So that's quite nice. So there will still be certain quirks, perhaps in East Germany, that you know, us Westerners don't know anything about. But as far as I know, up until, I mean, I don't know if I should have checked this ahead of this podcast, but for instance, East German civil servants were paid less than West German civil servants, even if they were employed by the Federation. So even if they were federal employees. And that was particularly nasty if you were living in Berlin, because you could have been from the West and you were paid 10% more than the person next to you who was from the East. And I think that is still ongoing, as far as I know. So you have that. So there's still a few hangovers. And obviously in certain other areas of law, like property law or a family law, where you need legal certainty, certain GDR, you know, divorce judgments and GDR acquisitions of property, they're still obviously around. They will never go away. I mean, that's the way it is. But I think the bulk of it, I mean, and I would imagine it was done within about 10 years or so. But I can't put a clear number on this. But it took a long time.
Yeah, Aoife.
I think that 10 years is a really interesting number, because I think there's a lot of assumption, even in the legal discussions, that it will happen very quickly and that all those things will be ironed out, as opposed to it naturally just taking a very long time to get these things done, because you are talking about masses of law. One of the things I found interesting is, and in my own research on this question, is the idea of authorship and who's writing up. You know, who's involved in drafting, who's involved in writing, and probably more particularly who's not involved. So the way you've described sort of the treaty writing, so it's very technocratic and bureaucratic. And of course, that is one way to take the politics out of it. To take the sting out is to make it a technocratic exercise. But I suppose in the history of, say, the first constitution in Ireland, you know, it was written basically from Westminster. There is a sort of history of technocratic writing of constitutions and structures, but also of treaty writing. And this thing, what makes the Northern Ireland scenario really interesting, because, you know, the Good Friday Agreement is both an international treaty, and we won't make comments about the UK's current view of whether or not it's bound by international treaties or not, but they, you know, there's an international treaty, but there's also a local party. The parties amongst themselves have also signed an agreement, and that model is a slightly different model to what we have in Germany, that you do have the two states. Naturally enough, you've London and Dublin, who will, you know, have to decide things like pensions, etc. That kind of monetary discussion, taxes, pensions, all those things will have to be decided. But there's also that local sort of parties in Northern Ireland who are used to it in a way that I think in the Republic we're not quite used to having that sort of level of representation of various interest groups. So it does, we don't, so that, you know, we would accept that the unionist community would have to be represented in some way. But say, for instance, the traveller community or feminist groups or the New Irish, that there are these multiple different groups that perhaps we need to think about in ways of authorship and then ownership going forward in ways that perhaps hasn't existed in the Republic, but has existed to the extent of the Northern Ireland Agreement, because it has that local authorship and ownership of the bit that's active in Northern Ireland beyond the kind of dual treaty. And I think that idea around authorship and who gets to be involved in deciding those questions, which, I mean, from one perspective, yes, we can make it technocratic and that might make it faster. It might make it take some of the politics out of it, some of the heat out. But at the same time, you also have that question of ownership and the need of ownership of this transition, which I think is probably a bigger disparity between Northern Ireland and the Republic than we've I think, hitherto understood in the idea of how these agreements will become to, if the discussion, or when the discussion, if and when it does start happening to a huge extent or a deeper extent.
Yeah, I think to me, it's interesting, of course, is that I suppose Schäuble and his team, in a way, felt it probably correctly that they had a sort of a broad democratic mandate after the elections in the East, where the Christian Democrats had done so well. So it was two governments of, led by the same party, effectively, in the two parts of Germany. And was there any, I mean, was there any significant pushback to the kind of the process as it unfolded, or were some people simply, you know, brought along by the desire for unity and a sense that, you know, it had to be done quickly and there was no point agonizing too much over it?
No, there was some pushback, or so was there was some attempts at pushing back. So it is really interesting what Aoife is saying, and I think if I had to make recommendations, I would recommend trying to involve a broader set of people in you know, making these decisions. They're really important basic decisions about how the new state should function and what it should you know, what aims it should pursue. So it's interesting in the sense that in the GDR itself, it all started as a grassroots movement. I mean, it was, you know, a peaceful revolution of sorts, but the grassroots were quickly supplanted by elites, Western elites predominantly, and that so on, and those grassroots, there was this kind of civil rights movement that there was, which was very much rooted in the churches, actually, because they were the only kind of free, semi-free spaces where people could assemble and have a frank discussion. They were disappointed, and they tried to come up with a constitution for the GDR as a modern state. And it's actually a really interesting document. It was also drafted by GDR citizens, and they brought in some West German law professors, among them Bernhard Schlink, who's mainly famous now for his novels rather than the law, but, you know, he's still a very, very respectable and respected public law professor in Berlin. And so they drafted actually a very, very interesting constitution, which had very modern rights. I mean, you know, they were very progressive, but being very progressive for 1989, 1990, they had a right to die and, you know, right to bodily integrity and right to bodily self-determination, those kinds of things that we might nowadays want to maybe put into a constitution. Not everybody, perhaps, but some of us. So there was that, but that attempt was didn't go very far. In the West, we had, I think, that the left, broadly speaking, was very skeptical of quick reunification, and maybe even of reunification as such. They might have preferred this kind of two-state model, at least for a good while. And that was born out of the anti-imperialism that the West, the left in West Germany had certainly grown to embrace. They did not want to go back to a greater Germany, Großdeutschland. They did not want to go back to German remilitarization beyond what was already there. That even was too much for them. They did not want this Germany be the dominant power in Europe, the biggest state in Europe, and so on and so on. So there was a lot of skepticism there, not so much because they loved the GDR. They didn't really. I mean, you know, the German Social Democrats were certainly no fans of the GDR, but they would have liked to have seen two Germanys, you know, coexisting as cousins or brothers and sisters rather than the quick reunification. But they lost the election. I mean, that was the end of that.
In a funny way, when you talk about constitutional structures and even adaptation of domestic law, I mean, I can see analogies, imperfect, of course, almost with the process of EU accession, that in a sense, it's a question of one territory or one country essentially adapting itself to the structures and arrangements of others. In other words, it's not really a two-way process. Yeah. And I mean, so just to confirm, I mean, it was essentially a question of the existing constitutional arrangements staying in place, but with formerly East German members of the Bundestag and the five new Länder that you mentioned and so on.
Yes, it was. And that was, I think, also an opportunity that was missed at the time. I mean, I think the German, the basic law was relatively open as to how unification should be achieved. So there was this famous Article 23, which was the accession solution that was used actually in 1957 with the Saarland, which is, you know, a bit of Germany on the French border, which was under French control after the Second World War. That acceded to West Germany under basically being slotted into the existing structure. The question was that the right way forward for the GDR? And some people argue, no, we should be using Article 146, which was the final provision in the Basic Law, which said, well, the German people, this constitution shall remain in force until the German people, give themselves a new one by popular vote. So should there be a new constitution that was then approved by referendum? And I think one of the reasons Kohl was against it was because they quite liked the Basic Law. It had worked. It was the most successful constitution Germany had ever had. We had had some bad experience with the Weimar Constitution, which was not a bad document, but it just didn't work. And so they were reluctant to let it go. It also suited the Christian Democrats in terms of its values and all of that. They didn't want to change things too much. They didn't want to have social rights and all this, you know, GDR legacy that one might have maybe wanted to include represented in the Constitution. They wanted the clear liberal or libertarian, almost Western orientation of the Constitution to be preserved. And it would have taken an awful long time to write a new Constitution, to have it debated, to have it voted on in a referendum. However, I think it would have given East Germans a sense of agency over the process. I mean, they were the objects of the process, but they were not really in the driving seat at all after they had voted in the first free elections in March 1990 to say yes to reunification as quickly as possible. But after that, they were very disappointed. And there was a lot of resentment on their part. Obviously, that was also because the economy didn't do as well as they would have expected. There was high unemployment, lots of change coming their way. And, you know, but there was a lot of disappointment, I think, also about the fact that they hadn't really been involved in the same way or in a way that they could have been. And if that had happened, maybe that kind of disappointment wouldn't have been there to the same degree. Who knows? I mean, obviously.
Yeah, a topic which has come up more than once in this series and in the Irons papers is the potential conflict between those things which absolutely have to be done in the context of constitutional change, those things which is almost certainly necessary or desirable to do, and then the wider range of other issues, often policy issues, whether how you organise the health service or policing, whatever it might be, which need careful study, but perhaps there isn't the same level of urgency or necessity to making the change. And this obviously, you know, but the German approach, as you say, the West German approach was very much to forge ahead. Aoife?
And I think a lot of that discussion about what we should talk about first or second or comes back to the order in which things happen. And also, I think presumptions about what might be problematic or not, because there is the model of slow change of the Constitution that, say, David Kenny talks about, or there is the Constitutional Convention. Instead of talking about it as unification or reunification, talk about it as an entirely new polity. And then as a new group, as a new island, we then, you know, that, and this comes up in Tobias's paper about there being a mandate to come back to things. You know, you have to come back within 12 months, that there has to be a new constitution within 2 years, that you can inbuild those processes. Because I think you've also got a very, and I think this is across the island, a very constitutionally literate society. But I also think a lot of assumptions. So there's sometimes, I think, in these discussions could be assumptions about things like national anthems and flags and things. And an assumption that some, or the Irish language even, that there's an assumption that that's a problem without actually asking groups, is that a problem or is it not a problem? Or is, in fact, the health service, and I think actually the health service is much more likely to be something of distinct interest on the island, given, you know, you have the NHS, even if it is currently under huge amounts of pressure in the north, and we don't have it in the Republic. And about the things, you know, the difference between things that theoretically can wait for reform, but actually might be more significant on a day-to-day vote than things that we think symbolically might be important. But in reality, people are probably a little less upset about, that we just assume that people are going to either want to keep something or definitely want to get rid of something, or even thinking about relationships with the Crown in England and how those relationships could evolve or change. That I think there, I think we tend to, and I think there's a lesson there from Germany about, you know, it was the economic issues, it was unemployment afterwards that made people resentful. You know, it was the bread and butter issues and probably less the symbolic issues that we, I think, sometimes here in Ireland on both sides of the border, or even in the broader discussion involving Scotland and Wales and England as a sort of much broader discussion, which I also think needs to come in, you know, how we'd relate to all different parts across the island, that also needs to be there. And I think it's interesting the way that Tobias think talks about the sort of potential mandates towards the end of the article that you could put in about certain things have to be discussed within certain time periods afterwards in order for things not to be put on the long finger, which things that in fact, in reality, on a day-to-day basis may be very much of import to people, and less so sort of the constitutional issues, that the less perhaps the symbolic ones are the less important constitutional issues in reality. And I think that does come back to authorship as well, and who's involved in making decisions about what we should start with or not start with.
No, I don't disagree with any of that. I just suppose that it's probably, you can, in theory, make a decision about an anthem in 30 minutes if somebody writes a new anthem and everyone agrees it, whereas putting in place a new health system for the island is maybe a different, a more challenging question. But I agree with you in terms of level of importance. And in fact, our last podcast was precisely about this. It was about participatory democracy and about the issues which, you know, groups of people on the border and women and you know, younger people had put forward as major concerns for them. Tobias, just maybe we can come back to the international and the EU aspects. And just to recall that, of course, you do point out in the paper that Ireland, the Republic, would be the successor state internationally. And so all of our international obligations would remain unaffected unless we wished to change them. And that was the case with the Federal Republic of Germany as well. But again, would you like to say anything more about, as I say, the broader sort of international law or EU law questions?
Well, I think it's important to realise, I mean, that is of course an important point. I mean, you know, we often read about the new Ireland, it would be a new state and all that, which is of course maybe politically true, but it's not true from a purely legal point of view. I mean, Ireland, as it exists today, the Irish state, the 26 counties would be the state and the 6 counties would be joining this state. And so Irish EU membership would continue automatically unless Ireland does an Irexit on top of unification and Ireland's international obligations, UN membership, membership of all sorts of international organizations, treaty obligations would all continue as they are. And, you know, they might have to adjust a few treaties to make sure that they also apply properly to what is now a greater territory but and greater seas, but that's about it. What's important about international negotiations is, of course, that realistically, Irish unity can only happen after negotiations with the UK about the terms. Now, obviously, we know from the Good Friday Agreement, which is an international treaty, as well as a community agreement, as Aoife has pointed out, that what the process, broadly speaking, would be for Irish unification. You need a simple majority of people in the north voting in favour, and you need people in the south also voting in favour, and that's the end of it. That's the question decided, whether unification should happen. But how it would happen is, of course, a big question as well, and that would need to be partly negotiated, I would say. Now, obviously, there are certain pillars already in place. We've got the Good Friday Agreement and certain obligations, you know, the birthright provisions and all of that. They are both states, the UK and Ireland, have agreed that these should continue even in case of a united Ireland. So Ireland would have to honour that as the new state, or the not new state, but the state that is going to absorb Northern Ireland into it. But you would also need to agree an awful lot of other things. I mean, what do you do with pensions, or who's actually going to pay for them? Who owns the hospitals, and who owns the military bases, and by what time does Britain have to move out certain installations, and what do they want to keep, what do they want to ditch, and you know, all of these questions about nationality rights. I mean, you might want to revisit the common travel area rights, maybe put them on into actual writing rather than having them as some sort of a gentleman's agreement as they are at the moment. What guarantees would Britain give to those in Ireland, in the new Ireland, who consider themselves British? Would they still be allowed to vote? And, you know, all of these things. I mean, all of that, I think, needs to be put down in writing and agreed. So there would have to be international negotiations, and there would also have to be some form of negotiations within the EU. Not so much that, you know, the big policy decisions would not need to be made, but you need transitional arrangements again for, you know, EU law applying to Northern Ireland. What do you do with fishing quotas and all those things? All of that would need to be agreed as well. And then, obviously, Germany introduced monetary union before political union, and that is a decision Ireland would not have the competence to take at the moment. I mean, as long as Ireland is in the euro, and, you know, as long as Ireland is an EU member state, it will be in the euro. That is a matter that is for the EU to co-decide, at least.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, there's also the question, I suppose, of a possible Irish obligation in regard to the UK national debt that was in the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921, and there are other important issues as well. And I suppose one of the interesting things is that a lot of people say, with Brexit in mind, well, it's really essential that we should know the answers to these questions before we vote. On the other hand, of course, there is every reason to believe that, you know, there won't be a very willing, that unionists will not wish to participate in such a discussion before a vote, and indeed that the British government might wish to hold its cards to its chest on questions of public finance and so on, in case it be accused of swaying the vote one way or the other. We're just coming to the end of our time now, but Aoife, before I ask Tobias kind of sort to sum up and his thoughts about any other lessons for Ireland, maybe would you like to make some final comments?
Yes, and thank you, Tobias, because I think it's a very useful article in that it sets out, you know, a model of how things can happen, and the most likely model, because there are other places like which have unified or have broken up or have founded two new states like Czechia and Slovakia. But I think the German model, and I think it's probably the model that in Ireland, I suppose, because it's in that sort of not only in living memory, but a focal point of people's political imaginations in Europe, that makes it such an interesting example. I suppose one of the things would be curious to know is that so many years after the event, are there any big regrets that those who were involved would have had? Not about unifying Germany, I don't mean it in that sense, but about the process, or the, you know, not taking the moment to rewrite the constitution and create a new constitution, or other things. Do you think there are any, I suppose, negative lessons to learn from it, things that, you know, roads not taken that perhaps might have been better thought of now if people had their time back again?
That's an excellent question. I haven't heard anyone regretting. I mean, politicians don't like regretting things in public, I think. And I watched quite a bit, you know, there's an awful lot of information out there because of all the jubilees we've had, 25 years, 30 years, and they put up these websites of full of videos and things. If you can speak German, you can watch them for months on end, I would think. I haven't heard anyone regret things, but that I mightn't have listened enough. I think the ones who were not involved, the you know, the civil rights people and those, they did probably do regret that, and they resent that still. But that's all I know. So I'm very sorry about that. I can't give you any more detail on that.
Just before I finish with you, there's just one other little point, a thing you do mention in the article, is that, of course, at the European Council in late April 2017, there was an acknowledgement concealed in the minutes of the European Council. It wasn't part of a set of conclusions at the time, because, strictly speaking, wasn't relevant to a mandate for a Brexit negotiation, essentially confirming that the German precedent would apply in Ireland. And it's funny, because to those of us who were involved on the official side at that time, it seemed kind of obvious, but at the same time, it was politically an important point for Enda Kenny especially. But also, I can recall about a month or two before that, I met the former president, Mary McAleese, and she told me that this was a big concern for many people she knew. You know, what would happen if there were, you know, would Northern Ireland find its way back into the EU? So I think it's important to recall that particular precedent, that the German precedent has explicitly been agreed as the model. But any final thoughts, Tobias? Anything we haven't covered or anything you'd want to stress in finishing?
Well, I think there are a few conclusions or possible lessons. I mean, the first one is really to be aware of the limitations of what can be done in a very short time. I mean, I'm no economist, but I mentioned in the very end the state capacity issue. I mean, what can you actually do as a small country? I mean, Germany at the time, West Germany was 60 million people. So it's a good bit, 12 times as big as the modern Republic of Ireland. And they managed to do it in 11 months, quite well, but, with limitations as well. So how would the Irish state be able to cope? So I think the preparation is important to have thought about things and even just thought about techniques of kind of postponing certain decisions that would have to be made. The second thing then is that there is a certain danger that the status quo will prevail, right? I mean, I think, we're all, as human beings, if we have something that works, why fix it? I mean, when it's not really broke. So, I mean, there is a danger that, like happened with the West German constitution with the basic law, that was a decent, good constitution that proven itself to be working. No revision was there was a revision planned for the constitution. It was put into the Treaty on Unity. After 2 years, we're going to revise the whole thing and have a big chat about it. But obviously, that resulted in basically nothing apart from some cosmetic changes. And something like that, I could imagine happening with Bunracht na Héireann as well, because it's a constitution that is working, and it's I think it's the oldest constitution in force in at least in the European Union, certainly. And it's still there, so it's a successful model. But just saying, "Oh, we're going to revise it at some point," is not enough. You have to have a firmer commitment if you really want to create a constitution for all. You have to have an expiry clause or something like that, so people have to actually react and do something about it. So I think having harder commitments, especially on reforms, especially if Irish unity would happen quickly. I mean, the way I would imagine it, but that's completely plucked out of thin air. You can't delay things forever. So, I mean, a vote happens and then you can't say, well, we're going to think about it for the next 10 years and then we'll come up with something. No, you have to deliver on the vote. And you can't lose that momentum. And, people would get very angry, obviously, those who voted in favour of it, if it didn't happen. So I think you will have to work with, provisional arrangements. But, it's important to make sure that those provisional arrangements then don't become permanent arrangements unwittingly. It was just because we're too lazy or too busy to to come up with something new. So, have firm commitments, have firm expiry clauses, and that will get people thinking about these things and acting.
Tobias Locke and Aoife O'Donoghue, thank you both very much indeed for a really stimulating conversation, and I heartily recommend Tobias's article to everybody. There won't be a podcast next month. We're taking August off, but we can be heard again in early September, when I hope to be talking to Professor Brendan O'Leary. Thank you very much indeed. Aaron's, it's a joint project of the Royal Irish Academy, the premier All-Ireland scholarly institution, and the Keogh Norton Institute for Irish Studies at the University of Notre Dame's Keogh School of Global Affairs. Its mission is to publish authoritative, independent and non-partisan analysis and research on constitutional, institutional and policy options for Ireland, North and South, in a post-Brexit context. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, you can find more and read the research in full on this and on all the other articles at aaronsproject.com. And my thanks to everybody for listening to this podcast. Thank you.